The Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Our first case this morning is in the matter of the civil commitment of Nicholas Webster. The file is A20-0128. The appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument, and then respondent will have 15 minutes, and appellant will have 5 minutes rebuttal. Whenever you are ready, Mr. Conway, if you could just start by just telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, and then your time will start. Thank you.
This is James Conway. I'm the attorney for the appellant. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay. May it please the court, we're here today to discuss that the court erred by failing to follow the clear statutory language requiring the appointment of a substitute decision maker in the context of a case concerning neuroleptic medications. This case concerns Nicholas Webster, who is a young adult who is staying at his parents' house and attending college, and in the midst of that, had a mental health crisis and was admitted to the hospital. During the course of those proceedings, Mr. Webster's mother, Sarah Webster, requested to be appointed as his substitute decision maker. Counsel also requested that the court make that appointment as well, but the district court declined to follow the law and declined to follow this court's ruling in the Rabine case and ignored the mandatory nature of a substitute decision maker appointment. As noted in our brief, the entire purpose of the substitute decision maker process is to take the power and control about making medication decisions and invasions of persons' bodily liberty away from the hospital staff or government actors and place them either onto the hands of the patient themselves or a trusted party who can evaluate those decisions on behalf of the patient. In this circumstance, the court did not do that, skipped that process, and authorized everything that the hospital asked for, taking away the patient's voice. When the legislature evaluated changes to the Civil Commitment Act, it specifically appointed a task force to evaluate what kinds of changes should be made and why to make them. And that task force did significant study on finding what kinds of changes to the Act might be made and why they might be appropriate. One of those changes was the creation of this substitute decision maker process. When the task force issued its report...
Mr. Conway, I agree with you. There is some language in the statute that supports your position, and you do have the Rabuin case, but I guess the key point for us is, if your client refuses to take the medication, the substitute decision maker, his mother, could not require him to take the medication. And, I mean, I think that's the key distinction, as I understand it, between, I hope I pronounced this correctly, the Rabuin case and this case. So if he's not going to follow what his mother says, you know, what are we supposed to do?
Well, I think that the state's argument that the Rabine case only applies to incompetent but voluntary acceptors of medication is an invented concept. That's not indicated in the Rabine case. The Court of Appeals also made a... I cannot hear you, Judge Connolly.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Conway. Let's say for the sake of argument, the mother was indeed appointed. He would have the right to refuse and not obey her decisions. Is that correct?
Correct. He could elect not to follow his mother's wishes, at which point someone would either his mother or the hospital would apply for an order for forced administration. That's correct. But that is the exact process that the statute contemplates, that first a substitute decision maker would be appointed, and then second, if there's refusal of the medication that the substitute decision maker consented to, only then would the order for forced administration issue. That's how the flow chart works and the language of the task force report reads, And that concept and that language was adopted in the statute.
Counsel, this is Judge Larkin. Can you hear me?
I can.
So is your view of the statute that it isn't either or, but both provisions could come into play? In other words, the proper thing for the district court to have done was to have appointed a substitute decision maker, and then if there was a refusal to take the recommended medications, somebody would have pursued a court order to require forced administration of those medications.
That is correct. If you were to review the...
So then, if that is how it's supposed to work... I'm sorry, if that's how it's supposed to work, what I'm wondering is, do we have essentially here a harmless error? I mean, perhaps indeed mother should at this point be appointed substitute decision maker, but I think we all know what her position is regarding the contested medications, and we now have a court order requiring administration of those medications, so I don't know that anything will change, except perhaps she should be appointed substitute decision maker for future decisions regarding medication.
I think there would still be error and harm here, and the task force indeed contemplated that exact concept. Here, if the patient were to refuse, for example, the drug Invega, that can be provided voluntarily by a pill, but it can also be provided involuntarily by an intramuscular injection. The record below indicated both from the guardian ad litem and the doctor that the forcible administration of the injected medication was much more intrusive to the patient than letting him voluntarily take a pill.
But it's my understanding he wasn't willing to voluntarily take a pill. Am I incorrect?
I'm sorry. I couldn't understand.
I thought the whole reason a court order was sought was because he refused to take the medication voluntarily. So I don't see this as a situation where they're doing forced administration when he's otherwise willing to take a pill. Am I wrong?
So he was refusing to take Invega that the hospital was asking him to take. Part of the task force report is saying when a substitute decision maker can step between the hospital and the patient, there would be a likelihood that the patient would then accept the medication that the substitute decision maker offered. Essentially, their voice might be better heard.
Can I stop you there? Am I incorrect in understanding that mother does not recommend this medication for her son? So it's not a situation where mother would be encouraging her son to take this medication. She doesn't want him to.
So the scenario you're describing
doesn't exist in this case.
She did not want him to take Risperdal or Invega. She did want him to take Prolixin, Haldol, Clozaril, and Abilify, or one or some combination of those.
I understand that, but the whole point of getting the order was to administer the two medications that she did not want him to take.
That is not correct, Your Honor. The order was issued on all six medications, not just Risperdal and Invega.
I understand, but I'm just talking about the reality of the circumstances. It's my understanding that she was agreeable to some, but not all.
Yes,
and I'm just
correct.
Wondering, and I'm playing this out in my mind. Had she been appointed substitute decision maker, she would not have approved of the two medications you just mentioned, in which case they would have gone to the court to get an order requiring administration of those medications, which is where we are now. So I tend to agree with you. The district court's skipped a step, which appears to be mandatory, which is the appointment of the substitute decision maker, but I'm wondering what the harm is given that there's no indication that mother would have encouraged her son to take the two particular medications you've mentioned.
I think the standard of review or how the court would evaluate that decision is a lot different. It's not a judge gets to step in and just decide, I would make a different decision, so that's what I'm going to do. The court has to evaluate essentially the capacity of the substitute decision maker's decision under the same standard of a patient's reasonableness. So the court would have to determine that even though maybe the court personally would have made a different decision, that the substitute decision maker's decision was unreasonable. So I don't think that it would be harmless error, because I don't think that there would be sufficient record to reverse the mother's decision. She had a clear and rational reason for not wanting to continue the medications, because there was an indication that each of those medications were not effective in her son, and she wanted to try one of those other medications in the hopes that they would have greater or better effect.
What are we to, Mr. Conway, what about the portion of the court's order where, well, first of all, do you agree that neuroleptic medication is necessary to treat your client's mental illness?
We're not challenging that, correct.
Okay. And you're not challenging that he had not sufficiently responded to less intrusive forms of treatment, correct?
Well, I would argue that it's more intrusive to have forced administration of medication as contrasted with having a substitute decision maker appointed where he might voluntarily agree with the decision maker's decision.
Right, but my point is, I'm trying to follow up on Judge Larkin's question, which is, you know, if he, you know, if the test is, you know, would, was her, if she had been appointed the substitute decision maker and had said, no, we're not going to give him these drugs, then it is, you know, then it goes to the, then the court would review that and say whether that was a reasonable decision or not, based on the record. And my question is, you know, does the record not already support that such a decision by his mother to refuse these types of drugs is not reasonable? He needs them in order to, you know, deal with his mental illness.
I don't think that was evaluated. The precise question you ask, I don't believe was evaluated by the court. I think it's clear from the court order that Judge Lennon had a different opinion on whether Invega and Risperdal all should issue as contrasted with Mrs. Webster, but it's not, the court did not specifically find whether or not Ms. Webster's decision was irrational.
Counsel, I'm looking at the statute, and I'm trying to identify the language within the statute that supports the argument you're making, which is, in the case of a substitute decision maker's refusal of a recommended medication, the court, upon request for court order, has to review the substitute decision maker's decision, as opposed to simply determining whether or not the medication should be administered. I mean, I'm looking at subdivision 7 of 253B.092, which says, when a person lacks capacity to make decisions, the substitute decision maker or the court shall use the standards in this subdivision in making a decision regarding the administration of medication. So subdivision 7 applies when either the court or the substitute decision maker is making their decision whether or not the medications are appropriate. But then subdivision 8, which concerns, you know, the court order for medication, Paragraph 3 says the court may base its decision on relevant and admissible evidence, including the testimony of a treating physician or other qualified physician, a member of the patient's treatment team, a court-appointed examiner, witness testimony, or the patient's medical records. So certainly under that paragraph, the court could hear from mother, but I'm not seeing that the statute requires the court to make an assessment of mother's or the substitute decision maker's decision on the issue. Am I reading this incorrectly? What makes you think that the district court, that the error here is harmful, because had mother been the substitute decision maker and refused the medication, the district court would have been required to assess the reasonableness of mother's refusal?
The statute in subdivision 6 paren G has the exact language that the court, quote, shall review the reasonableness of the substitute decision maker's decision based on the standards under subdivision 7. So it's not the decision itself, it's the reasonableness of the substitute decision maker's decision. So essentially that their decision is irrational.
Another way of looking at this might be that, and maybe I'm misunderstanding your argument, but it seems like maybe you're arguing that the question isn't binary, That is, all the drugs or none of the drugs, which was the dispute between the hospital and your client. There's a third option here, which is the substitute decision maker would apparently consent to the administration of four of the drugs, but not two of them. And that could, I suppose, be a reasonable decision.
That is correct, Judge Rodenberg. And in this circumstance, the reason we're requesting this is twofold. First, that the court is required to follow the statute. And second, if the court does not follow that less restrictive alternative of allowing the patient to take things voluntarily, they also infringe on his constitutional rights to be least intrusive. I see my time is up.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Conway. You will have rebuttal. Mr. Zettler.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondents. The procedural posture of this case, when it came to court on the substitute decision maker issue, this patient was already refusing. They knew that. When the patient is refusing, the only way to administer neuroleptic medication, unless it's an emergency, is with a Jarvis order. And the patient in this case agreed that a Jarvis order should issue. The patient in this case agreed that there should be involuntary administration of neuroleptic medications. The only disagreement was whether or not two specific neuroleptics should be administered, but they had no objection to the involuntary administration of four neuroleptic medications. I'm sorry, Judge Rodenberg, I can't hear your question.
Okay, it was the patient's position that he would not voluntarily take any of them, correct?
Correct. He came refusing, and that's a conceded issue.
Right.
So in this case, we started with a patient who would not voluntarily take the medication.
Any of them?
Anything, correct.
Right.
So when a patient will not take any medication, you proceed under 253B.092 subdivision 8, which is specifically addressing procedure when patient refuses medication. That's the situation we had, and that's exactly what the district court followed in this case. There is no requirement to appoint a substitute decision maker when that is the case, because there's nothing for a substitute decision maker to do in that instance. The substitute decision maker cannot override the patient's refusal to take the medication. In that instance, we automatically give the patient the very most protection we can under the law. It goes to a full judicial hearing, a Jarvis hearing, which is the most protection. The appellant in this case is sort of flipping the script and trying to portray a substitute decision maker as a less restrictive alternative, when in fact that is not the case. It can actually be more restrictive when you have the patient have an SDM, now have a Jarvis order, and now start to regain capacity to make decisions on their own. Now they're stuck.
In your judgment, did Mr. Webster, by virtue of the position he took below, either waive or forfeit the argument that he's now making?
He never made the specific argument he's making now, that he had to have a substitute decision maker and that's what we should be reviewing.
Right. So my question to you is, do you believe that he has properly preserved the issue that he is presenting now?
No, he has not properly preserved it. Nor did he preserve the due process argument that he made in his brief. That's also waived. He never argued to the district court that substantive due process was being violated in this case. So it's the state's position, or it's respondent's position, that subdivision 6 can apply. And subdivision 6 with the substitute decision maker does provide a streamlined process in appropriate circumstances when a patient is not physically refusing to take the medication. But if a patient does refuse, physically refuse to take the medication, we're not talking capacity, but refuses to take the medication, then automatically maximum judicial protection, full judicial review, Jarvis hearing is required. An SDM, a substitute decision maker, cannot change that, does not change that.
Mr. Zettler, I'm a little confused. At the hearing, though, following up on Judge Rotenberg's excellent question, okay, so we prior to the hearing, he was refusing to take all meds, but at the hearing, he said he would take four of the meds. Is that a fair statement?
No, that's a fair statement of what his attorney said. His attorney said they do not oppose four meds, but he agreed his client won't actually take them, so the forcible administration should be authorized. That was the position taken at the hearing. And the judge ultimately ordered, I mean, one of the objections is the forcible administration, which was authorized and not objected to. However, in the actual district court order, it is stated that first you should offer it orally, and if oral is refused, then you provide the intramuscular. So it provides that opportunity, at least, to try to avoid that.
So, you know, I understand he has sort of a unique, schizophrenia relating to his parents, but, you know, most people, you know, listen to what mom has to say. I mean, what's the harm in sort of proceeding as Mr. Conway wanted is, well, let's try, you know, maybe mom can get him to do things he won't do, and then let's see if he really needs all six of the drugs as opposed to four of them. I mean, what, and then if she says no, and the testimony is he needs all six, or he needs these two more than all, you know, then a second order could be issued. I mean, what is the harm in all that?
Delay and inefficiency, and there's nothing that stops mom from going in there and talking to him and trying to convince him to use drugs in the first instance. And in fact, she did do that. And there was not an authorization that he's going to get all these six drugs at the same time. That's not how it works. They're authorized so that the doctors can then work through and try to find the most appropriate drug that will work. And in fact, did find that. So there's been actually tremendous success in this case. This is a good ending case at this point. But the mom did go in, did talk, and the son still said, I'm not taking these. So when they came to the hearing, they were still in the position of, he's not willing to take any of these medications. So forcible administration was required, a Jarvis order was required, and appellant conceded that.
Counsel, could I ask a question about the statutory language? The opposing counsel cited me to Subdivision 6, Paragraph G, as supporting his argument that when there is a substitute decision maker who refuses medication, the district court's role is not to determine whether or not medication is appropriate in the first instance, as if there were no substitute decision maker, but rather to review the reasonableness of the substitute decision maker's decision. So it would sort of be a lesser standard or less authority for the court in terms of ordering medication. I don't know how familiar you are with the statutory language, and perhaps this is a question that can be answered on rebuttal, but the introductory language to Paragraph G says, if there is no hearing after the preliminary hearing. So it's referring to a preliminary hearing, and I don't see anything in subdivision 6 that talks about a hearing in the first instance. Can you shed any light on what this language means? I'm trying to read that paragraph in the context of all of subdivision 6, and it's not making any sense to me. Do you understand it?
Not necessarily entirely, and part of that goes to, in this case at least, the fact that they're raising it for the first time here at oral argument, so it's waived. But a substitute decision maker can be appointed earlier on in the process, and if everything goes according to plan and they're able to reach agreement and the patient takes the medication and doesn't refuse it, that is the streamlined process that works well. But somebody can, and this subdivision G provides the court with the ability, or any party, it says, with the ability to have review of that decision. So I think that's what it means. It's certainly not an issue in this case because it's never been brought up before.
So that might be a situation where there are separated parents who disagree. Mom's a substitute decision maker. She says, yes, go ahead and give the medication. Dad disagrees, so he asks for a hearing to review the reasonableness of mom's decision.
Yes, and though... So
this would be really for third-party challenges, as opposed... So this isn't a situation where somebody goes to the court and says, we want a court order for medication. And in that situation, we would use the normal standards that we use in reviewing whether or not there should be medication, as opposed to Parent G, which is sort of a challenge to a substitute decision maker's decision, perhaps to agree to the medication.
Yes.
That would make some sense. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
I say particularly...
Oh, go ahead.
Particularly in a case where the patient refuses the medication, you would not proceed that way at all. You have to go straight to a Jarvis hearing.
Right. So maybe this G is just in a case where a substitute decision maker approves it, patient's willing to take it, some other interested person who's interested in the well-being of the patient doesn't think it's a good idea and wants to challenge the substitute decision maker's decision.
Yes.
And that would make sense then, because then you would be referred to subdivision 7. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Unless the court has any other questions for me on any of the other issues, I would simply rely on my brief for the remainder.
I have none.
No, we don't. Thank you, Mr. Zettler. Mr. Conway, you'll have the last word, sir.
Mentioning this concept, I think that the issue is that the appellant or that the respondent is raising is that you need to read the whole statute together. But if you do that, what you come to understand is that the substitute decision maker process should occur before the contested Jarvis proceeding. So there would be no way to raise below the issue that we are raising here on appeal in the manner in which Judge Larkin was asking. What we've had to do is say the judge violated the statute by not appointing the substitute decision maker in the first instance. So there wouldn't be this follow-along hearing that's in that precatory sentence in G, because here the hospital never sought a substitute decision maker before it jumped all the way to the Jarvis process. So we're not going to get it in that timeline because that timeline didn't exist in this case. The issue here is that...
You know, I wanted to follow up on a point Mr. Zettler made. Did your client testify at the hearing that he would take any of these medications?
My client didn't testify at the hearing at all. At the time of the hearing, there was some discussion with Sarah Webster that he had a history of taking some of these medications, and then there was a change at the hospital where they wanted him to take Invega, and he was refusing that. Mrs. Webster agreed that the Invega was not appropriate, and then the court never appointed her to actually formalize that decision. Here, it's much more restrictive for the court to issue its forced order than allow the substitute decision maker process to move forward. We did raise that issue below. We specifically quoted and cited the language about the right to bodily integrity that's outlined in the Jarvis decision. That is a due process argument. And we asked the court, judge, do that. Do that less restrictive substitute decision maker process. That was expressly raised below.
So it's
but
your
the judge declined to do it.
It's your view that that was not waived or forfeited?
Correct.
Thank you.
Judge, we are asking you to reverse the district court's decision and remand to the district court with instruction to follow the express language of the statute and this court's Ravine decision, which requires the mandatory appointment. Here, the court skipped that step and followed the Jarvis statute, which is the court may authorize the administration of neuroleptic medications, but it skipped the obligation to appoint the substitute decision maker, and that is an error that this court must correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Conway. Thank you, Mr. Zettler. The matter is submitted. I hope you both stay well.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.